Right, yeah. Proofs are supposed to turn hunches or ideas into actual knowledge. So what is up with these zero knowledge proofs? That sounds utterly useless, right? In this presentation, I want to convince you that they are not, in fact, useless. They're very useful. And along the way, I'm also going to explain what they actually are. Bear with me. It actually connects back to the keynote this morning where we talked about digital sovereignty, and a subset of that is data sovereignty. Being able to decide what to do with your data, who gets to have access on your data and who doesn't. And these zero knowledge proofs allow you to treat data sovereignty as an engineering problem and solve that on the engineering side. In Germany, we have this wonderful word called Datensparsamkeit, which means only taking as much data, like barely enough data, as you need to do your job. And we don't always do that. And if you don't do that, it can be quite scary. So to illustrate that, there's a small story. Like, I was taking my son, he was about 5, to the pharmacy, and we were picking up a prescription for him. And on the prescription, like, you have the name, you have the address, you have everything. And so the pharmacist just addressed him by his name. And he got a bit suspicious, and I was like, why does she know my name? I don't know her. And she listened, she heard that he said that, and so she leaned in closely, locked eyes, and said, "I even know where you live." And then he got even more scared, and so he explained, like, it's written on the prescription, so you don't need to worry. This is not a spy and anything, and she's not going to abduct you or anything. And for the example of the prescription, like, in the physical world, writing these data on a piece of paper is just what you have to do because the pharmacist needs to be able, at least in theory, to verify that the drug is given out to the right patient. But in the digital world, we go about and do basically the same thing. So we need to prove things about ourselves at every corner. You need to verify your age if you want to access something, buy some tickets, buy alcohol, enter some venues. If you want to have a loan, you need to make some proofs about your income. You need to show your credentials if you apply for a job, all of that. You need to, like, provide your identity if you participate in votes. And the way that you usually do that is just mirrored after the physical process of going to somebody and showing your ID card. Like, if you want to prove that you are a grown-up, then you hand over your passport, and then with that passport, they get a lot of information that they don't really need. They have your full name, your date of birth, nationality, address, even a photo, your passport number, where all they actually needed is, like, one bit of information. They need to know your age is at least 18 years. But because we model this after, like, the physical process of going to somebody, showing them your ID, and then maybe taking it right back, this is just what we do. And this is a delegation of trust. Like, every party you share your data with, they are a target for leaks. And, like, you're not only sharing your data with somebody whom you might trust to a degree, but you're also sharing it with everybody who is going to hack their database. And you're trusting them to, like, keep that data, not only do nothing malicious with it, but also to keep it secure. And you have no control once you've shared it. Like, you're not in the, like, you show your passport to somebody, you take it back. In the digital world, you just send it over. And so we really should be doing something better. So what if we could, instead of providing a, like, your date of birth, you could just prove that I know when I was born, and I know that's more than 18 years ago, and so if I prove that, that's enough for you. Or if you, like, show your bank statements in order to get a loan, you could be able to prove that you know your financial history and that you know that it meets the lender's criteria, and so on. And, Lord, if you have a license, then you can just, like, prove that you know that you have it and it's not expired or revoked. And these kind of proofs, they exist, and they are called zero knowledge argument of knowledge. So argument of knowledge means it's somebody to convince somebody that you have some knowledge. And the zero knowledge part, that means, like, you don't actually tell them about that fact that you want to convince them that you have knowledge of. And so that's zero knowledge arguments of knowledge, or zero knowledge proofs for short. And that's what that is, and that is actually quite useful. It's not useless. It's what makes the internet safe for having secrets, and sharing like just as much as you want about them. Okay, now that we know what they're for, we should also like learn that it's possible to do these things, because it sounds quite astonishing, right? So in order to construct them, let's formalize what we actually want. So a zero knowledge argument of knowledge, or zero knowledge proof, is a protocol between two parties. It's a prover and a verifier. So you, the prover, want to convince the verifier that you know a secret, but you don't want to give away that secret. You don't want to go give away any knowledge about that secret, except for like what is specified. Like the secret would be the birth date, and you don't want to tell them your birthday. You just want to convince them that you know that you are more than 18 years old. In order for that to be actually useful, we need a couple of properties. Is that readable from behind? I'll read it anyway. So you need soundness, which means that if you don't actually know the secret, you can't convince the verifier that you know it. So it's like you can't cheat. We also want the zero knowledge property so that we don't have to give away the actual secret. And the completeness means that if you know a secret, you can always convince the verifier that you know it. And with these three properties, if we have them, then that's something we can work with, right? Let's start with an example. It might look weirdly specific. It's like it's a completely arbitrary example. We'll see later why I chose this particular example. So suppose both the prover and the verifier know two polynomials over a finite field, like integers modulo some prime. And these polynomials are known to both, and the prover wants to convince the verifier that they know another polynomial W, such that C applied to that polynomial, like in the sense of function composition, inserting that polynomial inside the other one, is divisible by the polynomial Z. Right? That's the secret they could know, and they want to convince the verifier that they know it. In order to convince them that they know the polynomial, we need to talk about like what does it mean to know a polynomial. That's equivalent to knowing all the coefficients, or it's also, oh, the LaTeX doesn't really work there. It's also equivalent to being able to evaluate it at any given point. Like if you know it, if you know the coefficients, you know it. If you know it at every point, you know it. For the zero knowledge proof, we probably don't want to talk about all the coefficients because that would give away everything. We also don't want to evaluate it at every point, but we can get a little help from mathematics. The Schwarz-Zippel lemma tells us something that we probably remember from high school, that two distinct polynomials of a given degree agree at most at that many points that the degree, like a constant functions, if they're distinct, then they don't agree anywhere. And linear functions, they have one intersection, and so on. And because of that, if you have a polynomial that has a degree of, say, a couple of thousand, this is something that occurs in practice, but your finite field is very, very large, then picking just one random evaluation point, you have a very, very small probability, like 10 to the minus into the 70s, of just hitting one of those points where they agree by accident. And so with that lemma, we can probabilistically say, and these zero knowledge proofs, they always work probabilistically, is that knowing the polynomial is equivalent to evaluating it correctly at one random point that you don't get to choose. So that's already a lot less information than like evaluating it everywhere, right? So let's propose a protocol. The verifier gets to pick some random number, or you could also get it from some oracle. And then the prover reveals two evaluations, or an evaluation of two polynomials, the W, which is the secret, and then another one, such that C applied to W, evaluated at that point, is just the evaluation of this polynomial times the evaluation of the polynomial Z. And so if that works, then they obviously know that polynomial, right? So question, is this sound? Like if you give me a random number and then I tell you, okay, like the polynomial W has a certain value, and then I have another value, and then you insert it into C, and then you see that this factorizes, does it work?
This is discrete method. 70s, right?
It doesn't, because if we just do it like that, then I get to see the random point, and then I can choose just values for W of R and T of R, and I also know what Z of R is. And so because I know that, I can just pick any random number for W of R, and then I can evaluate C at that point, and then I can just pick T of R as the ratio, as the quotient of these two, and then it works. And then I don't need to know any polynomial at all. I can just give you like some numbers that just fulfill this equation. So this is not sound. And the reason why it's not sound is that I can pick these polynomials, or in fact, I don't even need to have any polynomials after knowing R. So what you need to do in order to make this sound is to add a commitment. So something that that requires the prover to pick their polynomials beforehand without revealing them. And so you can think about this a little bit like if you have some message and you want to later on reveal it, but not yet, then you can just reveal a hash, and then that hash pins down the message. But to verify that the hash was the right hash, you need the actual message to do that. And the thing that cryptographers can do with polynomials is they can derive so-called commitment schemes that allow you to fix a polynomial beforehand, and then later on, without revealing anything about the coefficients, and then later on when you evaluate it, you can prove that that evaluation is consistent with that commitment. And so with that, and this is, I'm not going into details here because that would be like a cryptography lesson, or lecture rather. And with that, the protocol can be amended to add this commitment step, so you commit to the two polynomials, and then you get a random value, and then you evaluate them and reveal the evaluations, give them to the verifier, and then the verifier can check that this equation holds at this one point. And because of the Schwarz-Zipf lemma, they know that, okay, very high degree of probability you know the whole polynomial. So this is sound. The question, is it also zero knowledge? Not yet, because the verifier sees the commitments and they reveal nothing about the polynomials, right? Yeah.
I'm a liar. I can't commit to anything.
Yeah, but then you can't prove later on that the evaluations are consistent with the commitments. This should be in here. So yeah, this is a good point. You don't only reveal the evaluations, you also reveal the proof that the evaluations are consistent with the commitments. Great, thanks. Right, but they learn like what the evaluation of a polynomial at one point, and that is like a little bit of knowledge, but it's not zero knowledge. And in particular, like if you can do this repeatedly, you could accumulate knowledge. So in order to make the zero knowledge, you need to have something more, and this is called blinding, which basically adds a little bit of random jitter to the polynomial that doesn't really matter. We can see later on how you can do that without invalidating the thing that you actually want to prove in the end. But just for now, you need to know that like this is almost zero knowledge, and with the blinding technique, where you basically randomize the polynomial a little bit, you can turn this into truly zero knowledge. Right, so we have soundness and zero knowledge. So we can prove now that for two polynomials, you know that third polynomial such that the W inserted in C is divisible by Z. That's great, right? That's really useful. But we don't have completeness yet, right? So if I want to have any more general secrets, is this useful to me at all? And the answer is yes. And the reason why it's useful is that if you look at any kind of computation, arithmetic computation, then you can always express them as polynomials or as constraints on polynomials. So if you have addition and multiplication, you can build polynomials from them. And then if you want to have like Boolean, Booleans, then you can say, okay, you can translate that to requiring that the polynomial has a zero at a certain point. So the claim is that you can turn any kind of secret into a problem of that statement. And I'm not going to give you full proof that this is possible, but I'm going to give you a small example, a very like the simplest example I could think of, and then tell you how to generalize that later on. Right, so the simplest thing would be that, a very simple thing would be my age is exactly 18 years. You wouldn't believe me even if I proved it to you, but that's another thing. So we have one assertion, like the current year minus the birth year is 18. So it's one constraint. We have one private input, which is the birth year. And we want to turn that into a polynomial constraint. And in order to do that, we first turn that into an arithmetic circuit where you have like one gate that asserts one equation. The current year minus the birth year is minus 18 is 0. And you have one private wire value. So you feed that birth year into that gate. And then that gate tells you whether that is true or not. Right, and so you have birth years, your secret, 18, and the current year, that's public knowledge, and it's baked into the gate. Right, then we want to turn the circuit somehow into polynomials that then mirror this one thing that we can prove things about. And this polynomial W, the name of that is the wire polynomial, that is what encodes all these bits of data that flow into the circuit or that are intermediate values in the circuit. And so for us, it's really simple. Like we say, the polynomial evaluated at a certain fixed point W, omega is the birth year, that's the value on the wire. And so this is very trivial. It's just a polynomial of degree zero, so it's a constant function. If you had more wires than that, then you would do an interpolation. So you would pick unique values for the evaluation points. And then you would say that your wire polynomial W is the one polynomial of degree n minus one, where n is the number of wires that you have, where the polynomial takes on the value of each wire at one evaluation point. So that's the W polynomial. Then we want to also encode the constraints from the gates into a polynomial. And we do that by just saying that the C evaluated at a certain field element is just that equation from the gate where the value that will later be the thing that's coming in from the wire is just the element at which we evaluate the polynomial. And then if we substitute the wire polynomial into that, then by basically saying the V, instead of V, we have W of the evaluation point. We say that like C applied to W applied to X is then the current year minus W of X minus 18. And at the evaluation points where we say that the wire polynomial takes on the values of the wires, this then just gives you the equation that you want to turn to zero. Right? Is that clear? Good. Okay, great. Now we need the another polynomial, the Z, and the Z is basically what gives us the requirement that these equations that we have here, that they turn to zero. So that the C of W of X gives us the left-hand side, and then the Z gives us the right-hand side. So we construct Z as just being a polynomial that vanishes at all the evaluation points and nowhere else. So it's like it just has these roots, X minus evaluation point. And so it vanishes at the evaluation points. And now the claim or the statement C applied to W is divisible by Z turns into C applied to W at the evaluation points is zero. Because like the Z is just the factors has as factors all these roots, these X minus the evaluation points. And so if you write down C of W in factorized form, then it's just like the claim that it's divisible by Z of X means it needs to have all these factors of X as factors itself. So it needs to vanish at these points. And this, if we look back at this above, then we see that C of W applied to the evaluation points, that just replicates these equations that we want to set to zero. So requiring that this is zero is just like the original thing that we want to prove. In that way, we can turn that statement, okay, I have a birth year that is at least 18 years in the past, or that is exactly 18 years in the past, we can turn that into that form, like polynomial C and Z, which are both known to both the prover and the verifier, apply to a polynomial that only the prover knows is divisible by Z. And then we're basically done. So just to restate what the different parts are, like the statement that we know we can prove is that we know that Y a polynomial and a reminder such, or like the divisor such that the constraint polynomial is just a multiple of the zero polynomial. W encodes all these wires in the circuit. C encodes the gate constraints, and Z requires that like these constraints actually evaluate to zero at the gate positions. And then T is just the quotient, and you need to provide that in order to certify that actually like you know the factorization. So this was a very like almost a trivial example because you only have this one constraint, but it generalizes to having more than one gate. So for example, we could construct the same computation using two gates, one subtraction gate and one just equality gate, and then we could feed in the birth year and the current year to the subtraction gate. That would create an intermediate wire, which is our age, and then at another gate, this would be then constrained to be 18. Yeah.
I have a question about the protocol. Like, mm-hmm. How would the birth year be certified, so to say? Like, does the government need to somehow?
Yeah. We'll come to that. Yeah. This is so. The question was, why can't you just pick an arbitrary birth year, and right, and like, how is that certified? How is that connected to your own age? Like, because this so far just proves I know a year, I know like a number, and I know that like, yeah, somebody born in a certain year is 18, and that's not me, definitely. good question. We'll come to that later. Thank you. Yeah, and that is the way that these general calculations are then mechanically translated into circuits with like standard gates, and the same thing just generalizes in that way. Now we want to go from requiring that our age is exactly 18 to something that is more plausible, which is that the age is at least 18. And the way that you can do that is by basically computing the difference of the age and 18, and then requiring that that is a number that has a bit representation with 8 bits. Because then you basically show that you don't get an overflow in that finite field. Because if that would be negative, then you would end up all the way near to 2 to the power of 256, and then you wouldn't find values that create a bit representation of that difference that just takes 8 bits, because it's much larger than because of the overflow. So then these range checks, they translate into many, many gates, and so this gets quite hairy. Okay, cool. So we now have soundness, zero knowledge, if we accept the blinding for now, and also accept that commitment schemes exist and all the cryptography. And we also have completeness. The thing that we just constructed is called sometimes a SNARK, which stands for Succinct Non-Interactive Argument of Knowledge. And in argument of knowledge, we already explained what it is. Succinct means that the proof is like doesn't grow linearly with the thing that you want to prove. And non-interactive means that there's no back and forth between the prover and the verifier. Strictly speaking, like the verifier can choose the random number here, but you could also get that from an oracle, then it would be truly non-interactive. Right. So we're done. Like, who's looking forward to writing these circuits and expressing all their computations in that weirdly strange form by hand? Nobody, right? So maybe we can just drop it all into an LLM and hope for the best. Or we do what functional programmers like to do, is using a language that's exactly designed for this, using a DSL in order to produce these circuits. And there is a rich landscape of domain-specific languages that allow you to write your computation in the way that you would usually do it, and then they compile down to these strange polynomial constrained things. And there's quite a few of them, and I'm going to consider an example using one of these DSLs, which is called Noir, which has a Rust-like syntax, is quite clean and readable, so it's good for slides. The example that I'm going to take is basically sketching the European digital identity wallet. So that then answers also the question about how do you make sure that the date that you provide is not just a random secret date, but also actually your birthday. First, let's look at how that very simple circuit that we showed looks like in Noir. So you have some type definitions here. You have assertions, and the assertion that we care about is that the age is at least the required age. And the age, we calculate that from inputs, current year and birth year. The current year is a public unsigned integer. The birth year is a non-public. So that's the secret that you don't reveal. And then in order to tie that, in order to make sure that it's not just a random birth year, but actually something that has been committed to previously, you need something more. You need some kind of credential. For now, let's just say we publish a hash of our birth year. So we don't care yet about who makes sure that that hash is actually correct, but it's something that makes sure that at least during the proof we can't cheat. In that circuit, this assertion, the age is at least the required age, compiles to all this bit decomposition and stuff, so we get all of that for free. We don't need to think about that, which is great, because we also can't make mistakes in that then. And it's less tedious. Then the credential, for now it's just like a hash. And then the verifier receives the proof, which is the thing that has been computed by using the circuit. It gets the age, and it gets the current year, and then the credential, which is not a birth year. A more realistic credential that you would use is something that is actually signed by the government. So you'd have a credential that is signed by a privileged key by the government, and it contains a lot of fields, it contains your birth date, your name, your nationality, all these things that you don't want to share. It also contains something that ties directly to your device, because then it's stored somewhere in your wallet, in your secure enclave in your phone. And then it also has a Merkle root, so it's a structured document, so that you can store the individual pieces of data in a Merkle tree, and then at the end you have just one hash, and that can then be signed by the government, and that signature is also there. And then in the proof generation, you would add additional assertions. You would have the birth date that you provide is in that Merkle tree. You would provide a proof that the Merkle root is actually signed by the government, so that then proves that you are using a real credential. Then you need to assert that the device pub key is also in that credential, so it's your credential, not somebody else's birthday. And then you need to show that you can provide a signature, a challenge from your counterparty with the private key of your device. That means you have unlocked it with your face or fingerprint or whatever. And then you have that assertion that we already had in the example that the other party actually cares about. And with all these assertions, because they are encoded as zero knowledge proofs. They don't learn anything about the actual contents of your credential. The output is then a proof, 16 kilobytes about, and then the verifier can verify that proof. And all of these different things in the proof, they prevent certain things about, like, foregoing the soundness. The hash commitment that prevents lying about your birth year, the issuer signature that prevents you from just forging the credential, the Merkle proof prevents you from just taking somebody else's, like another, or mixing up credentials. Mixing up is the one, because then the signature is also contained in the same credential. The device binding that prevents you from just stealing a credential. The biometrics are used to unlock and then to sign the challenge. And then you have some nonce that you also that you need to sign with a device key that prevents replay attacks. Cool. How are we with time? Can I do the live demo, or is it, or just going through the slides? How much time do we have?
We have 10 minutes.
Okay. I think we can do the demo then. Right. So I need to look back. Okay. So here we have the circuit. I want you to do less. This is a bit right. So this is the circuit that we just had, and then this is larger. Yeah. And a bit to the moving it up, probably also good, right? So this is just the code that was displayed on the slide. So you have the type declarations, and you have the assertions, and then the compiled version of that is the hcredential.json. So that's a JSON file that tells you about the version of Noir that was used. It tells something about the types, the fields, and everything. And it's just something that's not really human readable, but it's compact. So if we do an ls minus lh target proof JSON, this is credential.json. And actually the size of that doesn't really matter, because it's not the proof, it's the circuit itself. We have a file that does the actual proving, and so that imports a bunch of libraries, and then it reads the compiled, like the JSON thing that we just saw, which is the compiled circuit. And then it provides here the private birth year. This is not mine. and then it also provides that credential, like that hash, the current year, the required age, and then does some logging, and then actually constructs a witness. This is basically then the witness and the proof. So that the witness is the T, and the proof is like the thing that is then sent to the verifier, and we can execute that. It's node prove. Yeah, so it's generating the witness, takes all these numbers, generating proof, and then the proof side is 16 kilobytes, and then the proof contains the public inputs and the actual proof. If we look at that, I think it's here. There's proof JSON. Yeah, so the proof itself is just that thing. So you don't really want to see that. And then if we look at verify MJS. This is the corresponding thing for the verifier. It also needs the actual circuit, because without having the circuit, like if you get a proof, you need to make sure that it's a proof for the actual calculation, that the calculation has the same form that you expect. And then it reads the proof. It needs the required age and the year, because this is needed, but it does not need to know the birth year. And then it does verify the proof here, and then does some logging. So, yeah, right. And then it checks that, puts out the credential, the current year, the required age, and verifies that the proof is actually a proof for the thing that we wanted to prove. Right. Okay, so we can skip these couple slides. Yeah?
Where did the random number exchange happen?
The random number exchange? Ah, okay, so right. So there, this is actually not, so the actual, okay, so this is the thing about non-interactive things. So there is a shared source of randomness that, and then, Great question. Okay, so how does the verifier know what's being proved? They get the same circuit, basically. They can check, and from the circuit you can derive like a basically something like a fingerprint, a verification key it's called. And then whenever you verify a proof, you need to, as an input, like both the proof and the verification key. And that way you ensure that you don't get a proof for something that you're not even interested in. So you can basically tie the verification to the proof and the circuit for which the proof is. Right. And this pattern generalizes because like you can basically transfer any kind of algebraic computation into these kind of circuits and polynomial constraint systems. So you can verify your age, you can verify your credit score, you can do compliance, like you could do your role like an audit of your financial data without actually showing the financial data. You can do member check and all of these things. You can check that a ballot is valid without actually looking which box you checked. Right, and so this allows you to shift away from the model, which is inspired by like the physical exchange of information that you have in the physical world, where you just need to show your data and then somebody else looks at it and looks whether it's right, where you can prove statements about your data, and then you hand over the proof, and like the statement to the degree that you want, like you can change which of the inputs are public and which are private. Like in the last, and like you can change that so as to make the proof as useful as you want to. Like for example, if we had the 18 as a private input here, then we wouldn't have proven anything. But yeah, you can basically choose how much you want to disclose. And so with that, if you then embed these credentials in your phone, then you don't have any data on an external server, it's just in your phone. And whenever you want to reveal something about it, you get to choose what you reveal. Right, and that works because these zero knowledge proofs have the three properties of soundness. Like you cannot convince anybody of something that you cannot convince the verifier that you know something if you don't actually know it. You can always convince them that you know something if you do know it. And you don't reveal any information that you don't want to reveal. So not that useless. It allows you to have an internet that is safe for secrets. Thanks. Oh, and I think
just out of curiosity, maybe I misunderstood you. So you're saying that it's somehow essential that polynomials uniquely determine functions?
So you can express any kind of computation as a constraint on polynomials because you can do any additional multiplication that basically that is in polynomials, and then the constraints are from requiring that they vanish at certain points.
But I can, yeah.
And you need the polynomials for these for two things. One, for the commitment scheme, because you, like, without the polynomials, you wouldn't be able to commit beforehand and then later on reveal that it's consistent with what you committed to without revealing what you committed. Like, that's something that the polynomials give you.
I can come up with two polynomials that have they are the same function, so they evaluate to the same values at all points, but they're different polynomials. Is that
no, better? No. If they agree on all points, then they're the same.
They're different polynomials, but they evaluate. No, but I mean x and x squared over f2. I mean, they have the same values everywhere. Right? They're different polynomials. I don't know. Is that? Maybe in that case, that doesn't
matter. I think I didn't understand. So
you take the polynomial x over f2,
and
you have the polynomial x squared over f2.
Yeah.
Different polynomials.
Yeah.
But they have the same values everywhere.
Because the field is so small.
Okay.
Okay. This only works in really large fields, yeah. Because you want to, like, if you look back to the reason of why the evaluation at the points actually is sufficient, then this is just the Schwarz-Zipel lemma, where you have at most n points where they agree, and the field is large. Like, this is always necessary. You need to have a large field that is much, much larger than the degree of the polynomials. Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds really cool. Thanks. So I was thinking of embedding this or in a small embedded device, the IoT device. Can you give me a hint how much, what are the technical constraints?
Device?
Do you need a special crypto, two random number generators?
So the proof generation generally is what is expensive, and you need to be good at polynomial arithmetic and elliptic curve cryptography. So there is. It depends on the, so the yeah it it it, it de- so so there's various schemes that you can use, and so the whole generality, of course, is a bit of a white lie, because you run into constraints with the size of the circuit, because these circuits, they get quite large quite quickly, you can construct proof on embedded devices. I'm not sure about the specifications that you need, so I'll need to look that up. Yeah. But it's possible, but it's always something that you need to have in mind. Yeah.
But could you possibly reverse the thing and, like, that the verifier in some sense has to do some computation given something that the prover gives?
So there are different schemes. There are, like, interactive schemes where you have a back and forth, and these are also a bit easier to understand, because, like, if we have a back and forth, you ask me questions repeatedly, then I can convince you by always answering correct that I know that after a while. But in practice, like, these non-interactive ones, they're much more useful, because you can do them once, and then the proof can be verified by anybody. In the interactive schemes, you need to trust that the verifier is honest if you want to see that the proof is valid. If it's a non-interactive one, then the verifier doesn't have any freedom to do anything, and so if you see that, like, the verification succeeded, then it just succeeded, and you don't need any trust in that other party. And the interactive ones work when you are the verifier, because you trust yourself, hopefully.
Is your scheme anonymous? If I sign on three pages and tell them my age, can they correlate that it was the same user doing this? And also, if I do it, like, twice, like, over a year, for example.
So typically the scheme, as I explained it right here, might not be anonymous, because you would, in order to make it anonymous, you would need to add some randomness to the thing, like some kind of nonce, in order to make sure that you can't recognize the credential, because the credential is the thing that you could start tracking. But it's possible to extend it to something that is anonymous. Yeah, great question. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you, for some of the examples you gave at the end, don't you always need some external party that also confirms the data you have? You gave the example of this financial information. I mean, the same argument that you had for
yes.
the birth data.
Yeah.
It applies there as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you need to have yes. Yes.
Not necessarily data about you.
Yes. So you need to you always need to have one source of truth for the things that you claim, and so for the financial data that might be like digitally signed records of your bank statements. Yeah. But then you don't need to, and if they are sufficiently structured, just like the credential was, then you can like select which entry is you disclose. Yeah. Great question.
Okay. Yeah, we're perfectly on time.
Ah.
And thanks, Philip, again.